That was rude.
Welcome to Thinking Deeply About Primary Education, the podcast that makes time and space to think about pedagogy, teaching and learning, professional development, anything of interest to time-poor but enthusiasm-rich primary teachers. This week, I'm joined by Shannon Doherty.
Hello.
And Neil Almond.
Good to be back.
And this week, we're going to field some unseen questions from listeners. We met Charles at Research Ed Birmingham. Or was it Research Ed Warrington? It was around that period in March. And he sent in a question before. And he said if he realized it was going to be read out on the podcast, he would have asked more questions, I think. So clearly, those who do send them in enjoy these. And hopefully everyone else finds them useful too. So the first one came on Twitter. We may have semi-fielded it, but I think it's a really interesting one. It said, I'm looking for top tips for delivering math subject knowledge CPD to teachers. I have 2 10-minute sessions per week. What do I do? Now, we don't have to answer with math because I think subject knowledge in general, and particularly in a primary context, is quite an interesting scenario because how do we find the time to improve our subject knowledge? Because, I mean, it was just last week, Shannon, you mentioned about how many subjects we have to teach and the thought that needs to go into it. What would your ideal situation be? I've got my 3 bullet points, but I'll let you guys go first.
There's nothing necessarily a massive thing. So I think a kind of a principle could be like some high leverage stuff. So thinking about your subjects, and I've immediately gone towards a math sort of English lens on this, which, you know, may not necessarily be the right one, but certainly I think identifying, you know, really high leverage areas within those curriculum areas to consider subject knowledge is really important. Equally, you know, really understanding like what a sentence is. You see some sort of examples, you know, a sentence communicates like a single idea, but, you know, that's an example, I think, of a definition that only communicates more abstractness as to what a full idea may actually be. And so I think, you know, I always find it quite strange that subject and object doesn't come up until like year 6 in the curriculum for Key Stage 2. And, you know, it's really something that I think, you know, Key Stage 1, even early years teachers, less so object, but definitely sort of the subject of a sentence needs to be there as well. So there's sort of another example of some high leverage bits and pieces.
It's hard to make a suggestion because I think it should always be from like a needs-based area. So I think you have to know what's going on in your school and you need to know what your teachers need, what's coming up in sequences of learning and plan it that way. I think you need to have like very open, frank conversations with staff about what they feel they need and go from there. I think the kind of the basics that Neil has covered are important. And I think we could probably all come up with ideas for maths that we think are really important and English that are really important. And if we were looking at a humanities curriculum, you might, I don't know if you've got like a selection of substantive concepts that you have planned in as like those kind of like threads in your curriculum, then that may well be a place that you could start. But I think it needs to come from the people in the building delivering the teaching. Otherwise, it's not going to hit the mark. And we've all sat in CPD before that we felt we haven't needed. So my answer really is go with what you feel is needed based on kind of teacher voice and learning walks and what you know is coming next.
Only thing to add on that one would be that is obviously there's, you know, lots of resources out there, and, you know, this good podcast has, I think, done at least 2 episodes, I think, of myself, Chris and you, Kieran, I think, providing resources, you know, high quality resources that aim to improve subject knowledge. within different areas of the curriculum. So I've no doubt those will appear in the magical show notes as well, and they're always a good place to start with. And of course, you know, leaders, subject leaders, whomever it may be, can obviously, you know, hand provide those links to staff as they see fit.
If you've got a couple of slots a week, encouraging some self-directed study, maybe in the, you know, maybe you're in the same room so you can be on hand, but getting them into the habit of finding what they need themselves so that when they are planning, they can do that in their PPA time. So yes, it's great to deliver it, but sometimes we need to just be able to find it ourselves, and teachers don't always know where to go, kind of what sources to look at, what's, you know, things like if you have memberships to subject associations, making sure that you're sharing those and that people can access them, things like podcasts or webinars, just so you can curate a bank of resources, but kind of encouraging people to take it upon themselves rather than expecting for all of the subject knowledge to be delivered.
Agreed. I think there's nothing, you know, I've been guilty of this so many times of delivering, you know, even, you know, CPD, let's put the subject knowledge aside for a second. And, you know, I'm really in the back of my head, I'm thinking, our EYFS lead probably not getting much from this at all. So, you know, obviously going through the, perhaps the, a brief history of the British Isles in terms of the invasion and settlement and all of that stuff, you know, useful for our year 1 to 6 colleagues, you know, maybe less so for our EYFS.
Helpful to know like where they've got to get to, but I, you know, there is something to be said about the fact that our time is precious and we need to strike that balance of directed stuff that we feel is important whole school, which is why I kind of talked about those like concepts that run through. Or, you know, if we're thinking maths, then thinking about those threads or those common misconceptions that come up year on year, or those things that we really feel are important, so models, language, that we want to be consistent every year. But also kind of the other side of that balance is going with what they need rather than what everyone needs.
Nice. So, I mean, you think you've got five principles or five sort of pieces of advice there. High leverage, content perhaps takes precedence, choose things on a needs basis based on frank conversations, point teachers in the direction of resources which help them engage with the broader field, encourage self-directed study, and make it appropriate for phase and stage because our time is precious. So I think that's excellent work from Team Shalmond. It didn't even cross my mind that obviously I'd seen the question whenever I said, oh, I've got my three bullet points. That must sound really smart. Oh, come on, guys. Why haven't you got your three bullet points?
Well, there you go. We have five now.
Yeah.
I suggested that they map session content to what's likely to be taught. So there's space between the session and teaching. Because if I do my place value session in September or September 5th, and then I'm teaching place value on September 6th, I'm not sure that's going to be useful, but we can look at what's happening down the line. Decide on a core message for each session, and then have carefully chosen examples and non-examples. So like, I think that goes back to your high leverage content. You know, you can't possibly cover everything. What is it I really want teachers to understand, and how is that going to apply out? And then consider if you can possibly thread a message through each of the sessions so that there's a constant narrative that you're coming back to. You're like, oh, remember last time we talked about this? Well, this piece of the puzzle fits into that. And I think that would work with your substantive concepts as well, because you're like, oh, look at this big rounded picture we have. So I think I don't think we're a million miles away, but I think it is immensely difficult in a primary context. And if anyone has any good strategies, you know, I know Lloyd, obviously we talk about it all the time, gives his teachers full days. But if anyone has any strategies, love to hear about them. And actually, be great to chat on the podcast about it. And you're right, Neil. I think we did two subject knowledge compendia, and we have so much information contained within it that Chris Such said we couldn't possibly do a third one, even though it was our annual pre-Christmas tradition. He said, no, it's full. So, you know.
What a Grinch.
And soon we'll be able to add, is it Paul McGann's book? No, not Paul McGann. He used to do short histories, didn't he?
Who wrote? He should do.
Who wrote or who is going to publish this month, I think, The Fall of Civilizations? What's his name?
Remember what his name is.
I don't know, and we've packed all our books up, so can't possibly check.
It looks massive, so I think look forward to that. It's meant to be out this month, isn't it? So, but I think it might
Yeah,
be
I believe
May.
so. I'm wondering if it is just a transcription of all his podcasts. I mean, I'd be very happy if it was.
Yeah, I mean, I use it to go to sleep, so I stick on the 45-minute timer. But there's bound to be bits that I've missed from different civilizations because you don't know when you're going to fall asleep, do you? You know, but at least I can't waste a full 3-hour podcast in a night. That was the hardest question because I know you look quite worried there, Shannon, whenever the first one was asked. But the second one I think is right up your alley. I'm searching for the next professional development challenge in my career, and I'm not sure what to do. Given the choice between a master's and an MPQ, what would you choose? And I'm assuming it's not an MPQH because obviously a master's and a head teacher qualification don't necessarily align, but the others are sort of in the same ballpark.
I would say an MPQ. I don't know if that's because I'm biased because I deliver them. I mean, at the moment, obviously, they've been free, but going forward, you may be in a school where you can get them funded. Either way, that it'll be cheaper than a master's. I think it does depend at what level you're at in your career. If you are a middle leader currently, then perhaps the senior leader one is right for you. I found it very useful. Or if you're not yet a middle leader, then perhaps, you might want to kind of go down that specialism route of behaviour and culture or leading teaching or teacher development, or you might be interested in SEND or literacy or maths. Like, I think it really depends. Don't laugh at me, I'm just listing them all. But it depends where you are in your career. But I think the MPQs are really high quality. I think the materials that I've seen, having done one through Ambition and having delivered them through the Church of England, I think there's a lot of excellent stuff in there. Old MPQs with a project, you would have had to do a lot more in school. And they were, I'm not saying they were better, I'm just saying you would have had to do a lot of the heavy lifting. Whereas the MPQs as they are now, you still have to engage with them and have, coaching or clinics, or you have to take part in the face-to-face days or the online stuff, and there's a lot of reading, but there's less doing now. So it depends where you are and what capacity you've got, I'd say. But I say look at MPQs, think and work out whether or not one of those is appropriate. And if you feel like they're not right for you, then hop onto a master's.
I think it really comes down to if any of the NPQs out there, as Shannon has just listed off, if you don't feel that they necessarily appeal to you, then obviously I would be skeptical about doing one for the sake of doing one and just getting the letters after your name. And obviously, when it comes to masters, every institution, the masters are that they offer are different, the modules that you can choose are different, and so you may find one that better suits an area that you're interested in. Shannon made an excellent point about the funding being a an issue. I certainly know that if you are in a certain larger mat, or if you are in larger mats, now and then that is something that they may consider offering to pay for you. There may be a sort of an agreement that has to be made in terms of how long you may kind of stay afterwards and et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, I think it just basically comes down to your preference and what you want out of it. And as I say, the again bias, the materials from Ambition, I think, are particularly good, but full disclosure, I deliver for them. And the reason I deliver for them is because I think they are that good. And the quality of that stuff, say, is, I think I never did an old MPQ because I saw and just heard of all the hurdles that people jumped through when it came to that project that, really it was a waste of everyone's time. It was never, what we now know about PD and actually what you get taught in these MPQs about, things being purposeful and things done with, the whole staff buy-in.
And the implementation that has to go into these things goes against that old...
Fewer things done better.
Mm.
You know, it's not... It wasn't impossible to work in a maybe a two formantry school, and three or four things that you had to do this year were just to satisfy someone's NPQ project. And, well, you know, that's a lot of cognitive effort and habit that you have to try and get into for something that is going to get stopped as soon as they've done it, or you never really did it anyway, and that data was falsified. So, well, falsified, it was fudged, but we'll go with that. So, yeah, comes down to deal with, go with what interests you. Because at the end of the day, you have to do it, and you're going to be more inclined to do it if it's something that appeals to you.
And if you are currently listening, which I'm sure you are because you've submitted a question, so you must be a listener, feel free to DM. And if you want to give more information about where you're at and what you've got, what you're interested in or what you've had before, one of us might be able to give you better advice than this kind of blanket that we're giving now.
And also you can look outside the MPQs and masters as well. I know like StepLab, they have like a coaching conferency sort of thing. Maybe you can help me out with that one. So that's not as... They have like a certificate in coaching, don't they?
Mm.
But I know like evidence-based education, if you sign up for the Great Teacher Toolkit, there are various programs and professional development through there. I'm currently doing their assessment lead program, because assessment, I think, is a low-hanging fruit of primary schools. And I think if we understand assessment better, that's going to improve. I think it's going to have a big domino effect on workload for teachers, sensible choices of curricula, and, you know, strategic directions that schools will take when they understand more about that. And obviously, you know, that doesn't come under the two umbrellas of NPQ or masters.
No, and ambition offer quite a few interesting things as well, don't they? Kind of like for expert teachers or like curriculum leaders. So it's worth digging around. But it really depends on what takes your fancy, where you want your career to go. If you know that you want to be a SENCO, do the NPQ and SEN. If you know that you have a real interest in behaviour and pastoral stuff, you could do the NPQ LBC.
So it's almost like one can have a really direct impact on your career, and the other one might just be for cognitive, I don't know, engagement. Do you, curveball, do you reckon if they raise the expectations in terms of the writing standard in the MPQs, that they would become de facto masters? Because there was always talk about it being a profession that's all master's level. And obviously lots of the research engagement, but the focus is mostly on implementation as opposed to the quality of the writing. Do you reckon there's a chance for the masters to become defunct if they were to put that expectation? So I think it's level 7 a master's is at, which is reasonable, but not insurmountable for most teachers.
You make an interesting point. And it's not something I feel like I could answer without giving some proper thought. But, you know, there is no requirement for a particular level in writing for an MPQ. So I think if they did raise that bar, then that may, I don't know, it may fall in line with masters, but it also might turn people off, rightly or wrongly. So I think what's great at the moment is so many people have done their MPQs. Obviously, the important thing is what they do with it. Whereas fewer people do a master's.
I was thinking they could run it like a, you know, a PGC, right? Because in that you get master's credits if your written essay is of a certain caliber. And I would like to think that teachers a couple of years into their career who have a degree and engaging with middle leadership sort of NPQs or above could be given the opportunity to perhaps transfer some of that writing into master's credits that perhaps some providers could accept. It would make those NPQs perhaps, you know, a little bit more desirable to some people. I think certainly, you know, I haven't got any NPQs, I haven't done any. I think if I had some, I think, you know, the offer of perhaps some master credits at a certain, if your writing is of a standard, certain standard, would probably actually appeal to me a little bit more.
I mean, I don't necessarily have an opinion on the curveball I threw, but it did come to mind just in case. I mean, I certainly didn't think we'd spend that long on that question, but hopefully it's helpful for the listener who posed it, and also for anyone who may be in at the point where they are making a decision, because as you rightly say, only a few of them will be funded next year, and if you're not in one of the sort of schools in the highest areas of or the areas of highest socioeconomic deprivation, to my knowledge. So we shall see. So I think this next question is something certainly that I encountered a lot in the classroom. It says a significant number of pupils in my year three class struggle to work independently for extended periods. Is there anything I can do to help them?
I feel your pain.
As a year three
As
teacher
a year three teacher.
with a class who struggled to work independently
With a
for.
class who some of whom struggle to work independently.
I'd be asking myself the question before they go off to work or try to work independently, are they actually ready to work within that content, i.e., are your checks for understanding, checks for meaning, whatever it is that you would like to call it, you know, are you confident that those pupils actually can do it independently? If they can't do it independently, they are likely to evidently not do that, regardless whether it be independent or sort of, you know, paired work, grouped work, whatever it may be. I'd be asking myself, you know, am I perhaps asking too much of certain children in terms of the extent and how long I'm expecting them to work for independently for? Might it be better to sort of create some shorter, sharper, independent activities, and I can sort of gradually think about how I build up that stamina of independent working. There's also other elements of things like, okay, so what are our routines and that we have in our classroom? That means that when you do become stuck, you know, there are strategies in place that mean that before you know, not intentionally disrupt the learning of other children or interrupt perhaps a conversation that you may be having with other pupils, but that there are some that there's something there in place that you know, the pupils can use to support them. Like I know a few schools have like a ask three before me, which is like basically I think you ask sort of like three other people around you for support before you then go to the teacher. And obviously, you know, there's a lot of explicit teaching in what appropriately asking people may mean and how you might want to do that, so that you know, the whole classroom understands what that routine is for and how to react appropriately should someone choose to do the whole ask three before me. Felt like you were about to say something.
Isn't don't some people use Ask Three Before Me as brain book buddy as well sometimes? So like you ask your own brain, you check in your book, you flick back, or you check in a right reference book, and then you ask a buddy, and then once you've done those, then you go to a teacher.
Like that.
That's something that I've seen. I would just echo much of what you've just said, Neil, because I think if I think about the days that I teach my class and when I'm planning for my job share, I think about how can we chunk up the content, chunk up the learning. They do a little, I do a bit, they do a bit, I do a bit, they do a bit, and ensure that they really are ready for that bit. Like, I think a lot of it is to do with what I talked about last week and that kind of extended handover of making sure that you've seen enough evidence that they are ready to move on. Because I do think there's something to be said about some children obviously are just going to want to chat, and it's not because of any deep reason other than they feel like chatting. But there will be children who are seemingly unable to work independently because they are just not ready in that lesson with that content, that material, whatever it is. So ensuring that you've done that kind of extended handover, you've seen them doing it on a whiteboard or in different contexts, or they've been able to verbalize it, you've done your cold calling, all of those things, you've done your checks. And then what are you giving them to make sure that they can be independent? So what scaffolding is in place? Is there a faded approach that you can put into some things? You know, if you're writing sentences, can they complete some before and build up more and more to writing it independently? If it's a kind of a procedural thing in maths, can you break that down into steps and then they only have to do one step, then two, and then so on? Just because they are small, you know, year three are they're 7 and 8, they're not old. And I think sometimes we do expect quite a lot from them. So I definitely agree as well with Neil saying, how long are you expecting them to work independently for? Because there's not always a reason to kind of sit almost silently for half of a lesson working, because that might not be conducive to them actually learning. I feel like I've waffled, but some of it might be helpful.
I think it'll all be helpful. I mean, you've got checking for understanding or your extended handover, making sure that's in place and that's robust. Ask yourself how much you're asking them to do in terms of time and extent. Consider what the routines might be for getting unstuck. And Re and Book Buddy sounded like the sort of the go-to strategy. I can imagine asking your brain, do you know yet? Nope, still don't know. Okay, onto the book. But that might be an overly literal sort of interpretation. And I mean, it matches up with my experience. I mean, I had a number of year three classes over the years. Year three is very young. You know, you almost at some point you will see a big jump from lots of them. You know, they're not year two anymore, but they're still not quite old enough for really extensive periods of time on their own. And sometimes the same strategies haven't worked every time. I've had to pivot and use different things at different times with different classes. It's not like, you know, oh, I have this is how I deal with year three. It's very much a case of take them on a case by case basis. And like I always try to incrementally increase, even if it's really small at the start. Like, okay, what are we doing for 2 minutes? You know, okay, all right, we're going to focus on this for 2 minutes because it's the quality of what they think about rather than the length of time they think about it. And so I'm almost thinking, right, okay, I'm going to give them to the year four teacher in a really good place, or certainly in a better place than they've come. So that's how I've always gone about it. And I think if it were a different year group from year three, then it might be a bit more intense, because if you get year five, where you're really expecting to think about some complex and complex in terms of there are many moving parts within the curriculum, within year five and year six. If you're asking them to, you do need to ask them to focus for a lot longer, certainly in terms of how much they're expected to write, the quality of what they're expected to write, and goes across all the subjects. Then I think it's a much more intense question, and you may need to really think about those routines, because at some point they will not have developed the sort of the stamina that perhaps is needed, because they are only 2 years away from secondary school, and then they're on their own essentially, aren't they? I mean, Neil, you were making slightly interesting faces when I was giving that response. Is there was it the response, or were you challenging, just continuing to fight with each other?
I knocked over a can of Pepsi, but it was empty, so it's okay.
And then when you tried to fix it, it then fell over the other way, so.
I was mentioning the complexity of year five and all. Does he disagree? Is year five really easy? Have I forgotten
Year
in the
five
time?
is so easy, Kieran. I'm going to add one thing. It can be easy, I think, especially when you're a year three teacher, to compare yourself to the rest of Key Stage 2, and to, you know, whether you've done drop-ins or learning walks, or you just get a feel when you kind of walk around the school or talk to your colleagues that they should be doing more or working for longer, or that they should be more independent now they're in Key Stage 2. But just remember that they are young. They've only just come out of Key Stage 1, where the expectation was less, still hard for them. It was challenging because it was new. But they don't have to write as much. You know, they don't have to do quite so many complex things. And just like, don't be hard on yourself if you think they're not working independently enough or for long enough. because you're probably doing a really good job. Just think about the things that we've all said, and just remember that it's okay if they need a bit of more support or a bit more structure, because they're 7 and 8. They're not 17 and 18.
No afternoon break either. The number of kids I've had go, "Oi, geezer, where's me break?" Well, sorry, you're in the big leagues now.
Absolutely. It's no afternoon break for teachers either.
Well, I think your responses have been fantastic. I really appreciate your time. All that's left to do is say thank you very much for joining me. Thank you very much, Shannon.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me back again.
Thank you very much, Neil.
No problem at all, Karen.
And to everyone at home, until next time, thanks for listening.